From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Colorado River isn't that big, really. I mean, compare it to the Mississippi, which is 1,000 miles longer. Still, it's incredibly important. It's crucial to those of us in the West. The Colorado River supplies water to 36 million people. It irrigates nearly 6 million acres of farmland. It generates $26 billion a year in recreational activity. But it's so altered and controlled that the Colorado doesn't get to a destination anymore. We use it all up. In his new book, the writer David Owen traces the journey of the Colorado as a way of exploring not just where all that water goes, but how complicated it is to divvy it up or try and save its water. The story of the Colorado River today, after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. These baking hot summer days make you think a lot about water. Got to stay hydrated, got to keep the plants alive. If you're in the West, and in case you've forgotten where a good part of the water comes from, the writer David Owen has written a book to remind you. Owen is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He writes about environmental issues, and in his latest book, he traces the Colorado River. Owen says for most of the past 50 years, the Colorado made it to its original destination, the Gulf of California, exactly once. Because people along the way, we're talking the 7 states that use that water, use it all. And in that sense, Owen says that we use it. The Colorado is a useful introduction to larger water issues like energy and economics and leadership and climate. You can track it all back to one river in the West, a region Owen says he thought a lot about when he was growing up in the Midwest.
I think if you grow up in Kansas City, you think spend a lot of time thinking about other places. And Colorado was one of the places we went as a family. And you sort of – it's kind of 600 miles in any direction to get away from what feels like Kansas City. And then I went to – I think probably some of the truly most formative experiences of my life were a summer camp in Colorado and then later in a more outward boundy kind of operation that doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. And then one of the great miracles of my life when my parents let a high school friend of mine and me when we were 17 go off by ourselves for 2 weeks in what's now the Wemenucci Wilderness Area in southwestern Colorado. And it's – I think my mother still doesn't really understand why they let us go. But it was great. It was great.
Well, pretty risky. I mean, you know, the extent of your preparation, which wasn't much. And you were, as you said, 17 years old. But they did let you. And I'm wondering, did you – I'm not sure if you had any kind of epiphanies, but it certainly was an important trip for you.
It was. And it's different. I think it would be hard for my kids to imagine exactly what it was like because there was no GPS. Yeah. There was no – we didn't check in with anybody. We sort of didn't really know where we were going. I'd shown my father a topographical map. You know, here we're going to wander around here for a while in the mountains. And but that was all we knew. And now you can – you know, you go on Google Earth and you can zoom right down on places where we must be the places where we camped. But it seemed like – you know, we were stepping off the edge of the earth. The world is a much smaller place now than it was then. It really seemed like, you know, that you were kind of leaving the known universe, which is a feeling that I think would be hard to capture nowadays.
Yeah.
And so I'm grateful to have had it then.
Do you think about this book about the Colorado River as somewhat personal in some ways?
Yes, it is. It is personal. It's also – water is an important issue. We have a long list of important environmental issues, and I've tried to write about some of them. And I wanted to think about water and to understand water better. But it's so huge. It's such a huge topic. And then I thought that if I could follow one river from start to finish, and just describe where the water came from and where it went as we used it, I could sort of tell tell the global water story from a, even though I wasn't writing about the whole world. And the Colorado is an especially useful river for that purpose because it's long. It's 1,400 miles long, but it's not too long.
Right.
And I think the main thing is we use it all up. It doesn't get all the way to the end anymore. It runs out of water just over the Mexican border and no longer gets all the way to the Gulf of California, which is where, in theory, its outlet is.
Yeah.
And along that way, it's extraordinarily useful to human beings. It's close to 40 million people depend on it for water. Something like 6 million acres of agriculture, and most of those acres were created by the Colorado itself, the silt that deposited over eons, and a huge amount of recreation in what's truly one of the most, I think, otherworldly parts of the world, the southern Utah, northern Arizona, the great national park, sort of the heart of national park country. It's, why anybody wants to go to Mars if they haven't been to the Grand Canyon. I can't even imagine.
There's the story you tell in the book about a summer that you spent working in Colorado Springs, which in some ways seems like, at least from reading the book, it was one of your first awarenesses about water in the West, even though it would be years before you started wondering where this water was coming from. But would you tell that story? Because this is where you were starting to wonder, you were irrigating in the West,
right,
which we're all familiar with around here.
Yes, exactly. I don't know that I was thinking about the water. I just took it for granted that it came out when we turned it on.
Like we all do.
Because
right,
we spent the whole week pouring water on the ground, and then we would mow the grass that we had grown. It was at a condominium complex near Colorado Springs. And it had been built on an old quarry, so it was in high desert to begin with, and then it was sitting on this very porous piece of ground. So the ground drank the water pretty much at the speed that we poured it on, and it was just this never-ending cycle of moving the sprinklers, cutting the grass, moving the sprinklers, cutting the grass. And one night I dreamed that that my housemate had I dreamed that one of the Rainbird sprinklers that we used at work was spraying me in bed, kind of while I was trying to sleep. And I angrily thought, I'm going to tell my housemate not to water my room in the, right, in the morning. But it was only years later that I wondered, where did this water come from? And at the time, in that part of southeastern Colorado, the water came from surface streams and from the ground. Later, beginning a little over a decade later, the much of the water began to come from the other side of the Rocky Mountains. And there are still people who live on the east side of the mountains who don't know how much of their water or that any of their water comes from the west side of the mountains. And because it just seems like an unsolvable engineering problem. But they don't think about it.
Did you get a sense talking to people as you did throughout doing the research for this book that there's a kind of denial in the West? I guess most everyone, no matter where you are in the world or the United States, you don't think that much about where your water is coming from. Are we unique in that regard in the West? Are we in a kind of denial? Did you sense that as you were reporting this?
Well, yeah, I probably more in the West than in some other parts of the country. But, in the United States, we're enormously lucky. And even the water problems that we have in the West, they're not like water problems in India, for example. But it's true that it's the kind of thing that you don't really think about until it goes wrong. And just in fact, two nights ago in my own house in Connecticut, I got up in the middle of the night and I turned on the faucet and it was air came out, no water came out, which meant that there was something wrong with the pump in the well in my yard. And I thought, well, I'll deal with it in the morning. But I couldn't fall back to sleep, so I went down in the basement and threw the circuit breaker and it came back on again. So now I've completely, as far as I'm concerned, I've completely solved my water problem.
Right.
But it's moments like that where you realize that how much depends on this resource that you aren't even necessarily completely sure where it comes from.
Yeah. When did you first conceive of the idea of tracing the Colorado River? You say in some ways it kind of began as an accident.
It did. And the project itself just sort of grew, and I began talking to water people. And the research began in a really interesting way with a woman who at the time was working for the Environmental Defense Fund, and she arranged for the two of us to take an airplane flight from a group called Lighthawk that that connects people who own airplanes with worthy environmental causes. And a pilot, a very nice pilot, flew us in his little bitty plane over the headwaters of the Colorado. And the woman, Jennifer Pitt, who's now at the Audubon Society, said, "You can't really understand a river system until you see it from the air." And she was right. And you look down and see where the Colorado comes from. It's a huge mountain range, you know, system of mountains that gather precipitation from a wide area and kind of funnel it into streams, which gather themselves into a river that then crosses the southwestern United States and supplies water to extraordinary numbers of people, including people. I think in Salt Lake City, I'm sure people don't think about the Colorado River as a source of water in their lives because it's so far away, and yet it's one of the dependents, and most of the cities, in fact, that depend on the Colorado are these extraordinary distances from it. So it's useful to see it from the air, both to see where it comes from, and then also to see how really what a modest stream it is. The Mississippi River carries more water than the Colorado does in a year every couple of weeks. Every couple of weeks, an entire Colorado River's worth of water washes down the Mississippi. So it's a modest stream that has that we depend on, and not just in not just farmers along the edges of it. A huge chunk of the United States, a huge chunk of the American economy, depends on that river, and which is increasingly threatened by our own prosperity, by changes in weather patterns in the mountains that feed the river, by changes in average temperatures in parts of the country that depend on it, and and by a sort of a changing ideas about what our relationship to natural resources ought to be. And all these things kind of come together and make questions about resource use more pressing than they ever have been.
There was a congressman from Colorado years ago, you quote in the book, who said, "Intrinsically, the Colorado River is the most valuable stream in the world." And I wonder, is that true? Is there another river system so thoroughly drawn from as the Colorado, do you think?
Yeah, it would depend on how you measure things. The Mississippi is a huge transportation corridor and was at times in American history even more than it is now. The congressman was speaking almost a century ago when we had barely even really begun to exploit that river. There are rivers in Asia that many millions of people depend on. So I'm not sure how you would rank them, but certainly in the United States, it's a major resource, and it's visible. There's an enormous river in the southeastern United States that people don't think about because they can't see it. It's underground. It's an enormous aquifer that underlies most of Florida and some adjacent states in the southeast. And because we don't see it, we're doing worse things to it in many ways than we do to the bodies of water that we can see. But so I think there are important bodies of fresh water all over the world, and they all face the same kinds of threats.
Yeah.
There's a sort of unsettling image that I can't remember where it originated, maybe Scientific American or someplace, that shows the Earth and then shows all the water on Earth, which is a sphere, and a surprisingly tiny sphere, all the oceans, and then all the fresh water on Earth. And it's just a teeniest, practically a dot hovering over this this globe. And it really makes you it's a really an alarming image to see how there's water everywhere, and yet it's a very finite resource that we depend on absolutely. It's if you don't have water, you die, and not a generation from now. You can't survive days without water.
You say in the book that that water problems in the Western United States, they seem like they would be so easy to figure out and solve. But then you get closer to these issues, and it's like pulling a thread. It's just like trying to tidy it up, there seems to be something else down the line that gets messed up, and you start to see that you say every solution creates additional problems. Why do you figure that is? Is that, and we'll get to sort of the history of, you know, the law of the river and all those things here in a moment, but what is the essential problem as you're thinking about it, if there even is one essential sort of problem?
Well, the essential problem is that the less you know about an issue, the easier it is to solve, because then right. You know, the answer always seems so simple.
Yeah.
And so with water, you say, well, we'll just stop growing almonds in California, or we get rid of all the golf courses, or we everybody put a brick in your toilet tank and everything will be fine. But the once you start sort of peeling back the layers of dependence on any resource, and you see that you look at parts of Western Colorado, and you say, well, why are we irrigating? Why are we putting water on grapes in Western Colorado so that people can make not very good wine? And, but then you pull back a little bit and you see that here's this entire region. This is a major foundation of the local – of the regional economy, because that wine is not just something that people drink. It draws tourists to that area. It's part of what supports the economics of the entire region. So you can say, it's insane for people to live in Las Vegas or Phoenix because of its water problems. But you can't just take 2 million people and dump them someplace else. You know, send them to Salt Lake City or send them to Connecticut. Or we got a lot of people, and the dry places aren't necessarily the worst places for them to live, because there the scarcity of water actually puts some constraints on other kinds of environmental impacts that they can have. I play bridge. I have some old lady friends, and I play bridge with them. And what's true of bridge is also true of water, which is the more you learn about it, the less you feel you know, because you open one door and you see a corridor with all these other doors leading off of it. So these are problems that are not insurmountable. And because water is so important, we solve the problems all the time. Yeah. And you look at big cities in Southern California, that the cities have grown in population and that they use less water, not only per capita, but in absolute terms than they used to. But it's, we're fully capable of addressing the full range of environmental problems that we face. The trick is actually doing it, doing it in ways that are truly effective and that don't just stir up something else.
Well, it raises what seems like a theme, this conundrum that you keep coming back to in the book, that making people more efficient at using water doesn't turn out to necessarily be a gain for the environment if we just keep growing, for example. There's just more sprawl, for example. So these efficiencies that we seem to capture with water just provides us an opportunity to consume more. It seems like that seemed like almost as much the problem as anything that you identify in the book.
I think that's true in different ways of a lot of different environmental challenges that we face. And you see it with energy too. With the big question with efficiency gains is always what do we do with what we save? And so if I change all my light bulbs and I'm using less electricity, my electricity bill goes down, and it's great. I've saved this many hundreds of dollars. The question then is, what do I use those hundreds of dollars for? And inevitably, it's something that's energy consuming. Maybe I buy an airplane ticket and fly to Europe with my wife. Similarly with water. And with water, it's sort of further complicated by the fact that what we think of as waste in terms of our own use is not necessarily – its impact on the environment isn't necessarily waste. An example is there's a canal that draws water from the Colorado River down near the Mexican border and carries it to the Imperial Valley, this important agricultural area in Southern California. And the canal was dug – when it was dug, it was basically just a ditch through desert. So tens of thousands of acre-feet of water would simply leak into the ground and were lost before they got to their destination. And so an obvious step seemed to be, well, let's line the canal with concrete so we don't waste this water in transporting it. But when that was done, it turned out that the water that was leaking into the ground was supporting groundwater just across the border in Mexico, was supporting wells and keeping down the salinity of groundwater there, and was crucial to farmers on that side of the border. And it was also supporting a fragile ecosystem that then dried up as soon as the leakage was no longer there. So it was, we hadn't really eliminated waste. What we'd done was transfer a resource from one side of a border to another.
Yeah.
And I think that's an issue that arises over and over again with water. It's not – when you save water, you're not necessarily – you don't end up with extra water in a, you know, in a jar necessarily, because if that water was doing something that was good, like supporting groundwater, even though it seemed to be just leaking away, then you end up with a different problem that you then have to address in a different way.
It's David Owen. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. His latest book is called Where the Water Goes, Life and Death Along the Colorado River. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist David Owen is joining us to talk about the Colorado River. He has a new book that traces that river from the headwaters to where it runs out. Along the way, he explores all the issues and the people and systems connected to this one river. The book is called Where the Water Goes, Life and Death Along the Colorado River. You write this in the book. If you picked just about any high school civics class in the country, gave its students a year to gather information and to think, they could almost certainly come up with an approach to Western water use that would be more rational than the approach we have currently. Let's talk a little bit about how we got to this Colorado River Compact and the system that we have. How did we get to this point? I know it's a complicated story, but give us a basic sense of it.
It is a complicated story, but it's really interesting. And the in my part of the country, in the East and in England, where our law system of law arose, water resources are shared by people who own property adjacent to them. So you have landowners along a river. They equitably share access to that resource. That same principle didn't work in the West because there was so little water that if all users shared it equally, each of them would end up with too little to be of any use to them. So you couldn't divide it up because then there wasn't enough for anybody. And so in the West, in much of the West, this different legal idea of water use arose, which is known as variously as prior appropriation or first in time, first in right, which basically says that the first person to make a beneficial use of water from a stream gains the right to use that much water for that purpose forever. So you could have a farmer who owns hundreds of acres alongside a river who has no legal right to use any of that water until people who have older rights to that water have been fully satisfied in the amounts that they're entitled to by law. What happened in the early part of the 20th century is that people who lived on the sort of the states on the upper end of the Colorado River began to worry that California was developing so fast that by the time the northern states reached the point where they were in a position to draw the water that they were entitled to, California would have established a prior appropriation claim to essentially all the water in the Colorado. And so the states, the seven river states, the states that border either the river or its tributaries, had meetings over a long period of time trying to hash this out. And after lots of arguments and confrontation, they ended up with a document called the Colorado River Compact, which in the 1920s sort of divided up the river among these different parties. One of the tragedies for modern times is that the best scientific thinking at the time believed that there was much more water in that river than there has actually turned out to be.
Yeah.
The early part of the 20th century, it turns out, was one of the wettest times in the history of the river. And there have been long periods, long before we started screwing around with climate, when scientists call mega droughts, these decades-long periods when the West was very dry. And so the sort of the unlucky accident was that when the states divided up the river, they believed, in good faith, that there was quite a bit more water in it.
Well, let me underscore that because this is so interesting. You said it was an abnormally wet year. In fact, estimates were based on the wettest. It was the wettest years these particular years that they were thinking about when they were drawing this up since the 1400s.
That's right. It was a very unlucky. It was a very unlucky moment to choose to
crazy
to divide up a resource. And the only reason that it wasn't a bigger problem until fairly recently is that it took a long time for all those states, even California, to reach the point where they were in a position to use more than all the water in the river. Even still, Utah, the states in the northern half of the river's drainage don't use all the water that they are, at least in theory, entitled to take by this compact because they were slower to develop infrastructure and really didn't have as many. The southern Utah isn't as it's not an obvious agricultural area. It's a more difficult agricultural area, even with irrigation, than say Southern California.
Right,
so
right.
The consequences of this sort of scientific accident have taken a while to really sink in.
It's interesting too. You mentioned how John Wesley Powell had said that when you're divvying up this water, you should use as the defining unit in managing the river, not the states, but the drainage basin itself. Now, ultimately, we ended up not doing it that way. And you say that this view would have, if we had taken Powell's idea in the early part of the last century, that the Western U.S. would have developed in a very different way. And I found that really intriguing. Do you have a sense of how we might have developed?
Yeah. Powell's idea was that you should think of this whole river system, which sits on, I think it's 250,000 square miles. That's the unit. You should think of that and how you move the resource around within that area. What we've done instead is divided up by these completely arbitrary divisions by states.
Yeah.
And so you have states that are in competition with each other and who have divided up the river in a way that makes them think, if we don't get ours, California's going to take it. We've got to grab it while we can. So you have Arizona, for example, drawing water from the Colorado River and pouring it onto the ground, which is not a bad way to store water, to store it in the ground instead of in a lake, an artificial lake on the surface where water evaporates more readily. But it's the kind of consequence that you get when you have states worrying that if they don't take their fair share of this resource, then a neighboring state's going to grab it. So we better get busy and start irrigating things and establish our claim to this resource rather than everybody sitting down and doing what we never do as a species, which is to say, now what would the long term rational way to divide up this resource be? On the other hand, there are people who argue that the Western water system has worked incredibly well because all those this is the fastest growing part of the country. John Wesley Powell would have been amazed at how much use people have been able to extract from that river. He would have been astonished, I think, at the scale of agriculture, at the scale of urban development. He wouldn't have believed that it was possible to do that much with that small amount of water. So, viewed in that way, it's a tremendous triumph of human ingenuity. But in terms of sustainability, the term that we use all the time. In terms of actual sustainability, it raises questions.
It seems I guess it seems kind of obvious to me that if you're using too much water, you have to then figure out a way to use less. But there was one researcher who told you that water is, as he put it, I think it was a he, a super confusing topic for people because, is, and here's the quote, the language and mental models we use about efficiency, they don't work in the context of water. And I found that really interesting. So would you talk a little bit about that? Because there's this weird irony here that irrigation improvements, for example, can actually harm certain ecosystems.
Yeah, this was Bradley Udall in Colorado, right, who's part of the famous Udall family.
Yeah, we know that name around
and
here.
Still
yeah.
is. Yeah. And I differed with him a little bit. I said, you know, I think other kinds of efficiency questions work this way too. But what his point was, for a good example is the Imperial Valley, which is by any standard, they've been kind of – farmers there have not been careful about how much water they've used. They've used what they had access to. And now they're under a state-mandated program to cut back. And they're finding it, you know, relatively – they were using so much that they can – become more efficient in their irrigation. They can move away from flood irrigating, where you pour water onto the ground, to more directed sprinkler, closer, more precise application of water to specific plants, so that not as much is running off. But what the unintended or the negative consequence there is that there's an entire ecosystem in that part of the country that depends on the water that runs off of the Imperial Valley. And this is a complicated story too, because it's the Salton Sea, which is the largest inland body of water in California, the largest wetland. It's now about 350 square miles. And it itself was created by an enormous irrigation accident and an act of engineering folly in the early part of the 20th century, when irrigators in that part of the world accidentally diverted the entire Colorado River into what was like a big hole in the desert, the Salton Sink, and created a 400 square mile lake. It took almost 2 years to get the water to get the river back into its regular channel, and so it created a lake that was an environmental accident, an engineering disaster. But then that huge lake, that body of water, became an environmental necessity. It's a major stop on the Pacific Flyway that birds on the west coast of the Americas migrate up and down. And beginning in the 1920s, it was sustained. It looked like it was at equilibrium because it was sustained by runoff that was coming from farms in the Imperial Valley. Now that those farmers are trying to be more efficient, the lake is shrinking. It has no natural nothing flows into it except some rain, a little bit of rain, and nothing flows out except what sinks into the ground and evaporates. So without inputs, it sinks about 6 feet a year. And as it does, the water becomes saltier and saltier, mm-hmm. so that now almost nothing lives in it. And the question – this is the kind of complicated – environmental question that we create for ourselves is, which is, how do you build support to sustain an environmental disaster in perpetuity? How do we keep this poisonous, accidentally created environmental crisis? How do we sustain it for the birds that depend on it? So,
it's complicated.
There are people who have easy answers to it. Well, we'll just build a. You know, we'll build a tunnel to the Pacific Ocean, and we'll flush the lake with water from the Pacific. But in fact, because of evaporation, it would continue the problem. It wouldn't solve it.
Yeah. There's in 1922, when all these states got together in Santa Fe and hammered out this agreement, the compact. Two of the things that probably left a lot of things out, but two in particular that you mention, Native American tribes and their water rights. That wasn't even really thought of or considered, or environmental issues. You know, the idea of other species, aesthetic, as you say, spiritual, even recreational values. None of those things were given any consideration in 1922. say something about Native American tribes now and whether or not they can or have the ability to assert water rights now in the 21st century.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and it's still being worked out. There's a huge body of law that grants them an old body of law that grants them enormous rights. There was a Supreme Court case in the 20th century which said that the United States would not have moved Indian tribes away from their native lands onto agricultural lands if they had not intended for them to support themselves through agriculture. And if they intended that, then they intended for them to have enough water to make that possible. So that established the rights of the tribes to water from the rivers. And because that right precedes the compact, the courts have also established that right has priority over anything that the states divided up among themselves, because the tribe's right came first. And you could also argue that they had, you know, they established a prior appropriation claim before there were any.
A long time ago. Well, if you think about the implications of that, because you write about this, that all, for example, all the agricultural irrigation water in Arizona, if you followed that logic, could end up under tribal control. I mean, that could be amazing.
Yeah, it is, and it's sort of Arizona's sort of moving in that direction. But it's complicated, because in order to exploit water from the river, you have to be able to divert it. You have to be able to draw it off. The big diversion projects in the United States, something like Hoover Dam, that was not built by the federal government to benefit Native American tribes. It had other purposes. So without the infrastructure to exploit water, the tribes don't have they're in more of a bind. And a number of tribes have in effect settled for something other than actual water, have made other kinds of deals with just because of even though they had a theoretical right to the water, it was just clear that nothing was going to happen to it on any kind of reasonable time scale. But all that is still to be worked out, and it's one of several processes known as quantification, which is figuring out what's the quantity of water that these people are entitled to. And that's a big issue. And Arizona is an example where it could end up where huge amounts of agricultural water in Arizona would be under the control of the tribes. They wouldn't necessarily be farming it themselves, but they would be, in effect, the landlords for the people who were growing things.
It's David Owen. His book is called Where the Water Goes: Life and Death Along the Colorado River. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with David Owen. We're talking about his new book, Where the Water Goes: Life and Death Along the Colorado River. You know, you get to in the book, you know, what do we do about all of this? And you go through these various, factors and ideas, among them, you know, over allocation. And you write that if everyone used all the water they have a legal right to use, there would be much less than no water left. And one of the examples of this is Utah. And this proposal, for example, a couple years ago, 2015, Utah applies to the federal government to create this incredibly expensive pipeline from Lake Powell to St. George. And Utahns point out, you say this, that, you know, look, we have not diverted all of the water that we're entitled to. You know, and the pipeline, that's only 6% of our allotment. So you say this is going to be this seems to indicate that everyone thinks they have these rights, but there's not enough water to to make up for the rights, and this is going to be one of those tests, I guess, for the compact.
It will be, because if I were Utah, I would be angry. I would say, we made this bargain with the other states, and we've used only a tiny bit of the water that bargain entitles us to, while California has used much more than its theoretical entitlement. And yet, if there is less water in the river than the agreement assumes there to be, then something has to give. And then, this is why what John Wesley Powell was talking about when he said, the way to think about it is over the entire basin. Yeah. It's when you get the states banging heads against each other, it's much harder to make rational decisions and say, well, maybe we would within the basin of the Colorado, maybe if we're going to grow stuff, we should be growing it somewhere other than in the St. George area. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should be growing it in some part of California. But it's hard to make those agreements when you have the states looking at each other sideways and saying, no, that's our water.
Yeah.
Arizona has its own – California is kind of the 300-pound gorilla, and the Arizona has its own issues with California, which is that in order to get the federal government to build the principal diversion that carries water from the Colorado into central southern Arizona, it's called the Central Arizona Project. It's a huge canal that carries water from – the river, hundreds of miles. In order to get that, Arizona had to agree to be junior to California. So theoretically, if there isn't enough water in the river to satisfy both the legal claims of both California and Arizona, then Arizona is supposed to go dry. California is supposed to get all its water before Arizona gets any. Now, the federal government's not going to let that happen.
Yeah.
No one's going to allow Phoenix and Tucson to blow away. But these tensions between the states are real, and they've been around for a long time. And they're as we kind of come up against the ceiling of these resources. Some of the arguments get pretty bitter.
Yeah, it makes me wonder.
At the same time, though, the states are very eager. All the states are eager not to have the federal government step in. And so in recent years, you've actually seen states like California, Arizona, Nevada making deals that they might not have made 20 or 30 years ago because they don't want –
they want the feds.
They don't want the feds to step in.
It's one of those ironic realities you mentioned. And this is a region that's incredibly suspicious for the most part of the role of the federal government. But without federal money, none of these projects would have happened in the first place.
No, exactly. And a farmer was describing to me all his beefs with the federal government, and they were completely legitimate. And if I were in his position, I would be angry too. At the same time, though, as you say, all this infrastructure was built with public money and would not exist without these enormous investments, infrastructure investments by the United States. So it is – it's like the relationship between parents and children. There's a lot of stuff going on that's more than just the who paid for the car. There are serious tensions that go back a long time that have a long history, and that you can't just sort of – you can't wave a wand and make them go away. Even if as an outsider you say, well, this is completely irrational. All we would have to do is X. It never works that way.
It makes me wonder what kind of a plan the federal government under the Trump administration, what they're going to come up with. And you tell about this phone call you had with Donald Trump a couple of years ago. Would you just mention that?
Yeah, I was talking to him about something else. On the good side of Donald Trump, he used to take his own phone calls, and he would actually call you, and he was the easiest person to get on the telephone back when he was still just a joke and before he became a candidate for president. But right after he began running, I had called his office because I wanted to ask him about something that was related to golf.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the conversation, I was writing this book about water, so I asked him some questions about water. And he said, well, he said, you always just run a big pipe down from the, from the north. They got nothing but water up there. I said, well, it would have to be a pretty big pipe. He said, oh, it wouldn't have to be that big. There's all this water. It's kind of we now have seen that level of thinking as applied to a whole range of issues. But he also said, you can do that thing with the sea. What's it called? And I said, desalination. He said, yeah. He said, desalination, which gets expensive, by the way.
It certainly does. So
it certainly does. But I did not come away from that phone conversation with any sort of confidence that the federal government of Donald Trump would be doing anything to make things better in any of these environmental issues. His level of understanding isn't even superficial. It's non-existent.
What do you think at this point? There's always a conversation about managing growth, whether or not there if we managed development and managed growth, because the population keeps growing, people keep building homes and they keep developing the West, that if we somehow managed that, that could be some kind of solution. But I'm wondering if you think most people have just conceded that that's impossible. People are going to – Pat Mora, you talked to her. We talked to her too on this program. She mentioned how are you going to keep people from building houses and exerting their property rights? And I mean, how do you even do that? Have we sort of conceded that at this point, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think so probably just because the impediments are so huge. And it's interesting in environmental matters, even people who worry about the future of civilization tend to specialize. So you have the water people, you have the growth people, you have the sprawl people, you have the air people, you have the fracking people. You know, everybody has a specialty. And very often, you know, the solution for one exacerbates a problem for another. And there's not really the sort of generalist, I don't know what it would be, the board of directors of the environment that would try to adjudicate these competing solutions. I don't know that we would necessarily want to live in a world like that, but it's very hard. You see, Denver can be making very good decisions for itself that end up having negative consequences for other places in the West, or Salt Lake City, or farmers in California. It's hard to make everything kind of lean in the right direction.
It's important to point out, as you do in the book, that agriculture accounts for about 80% of all of the Colorado River water consumption. But what do you do about that? How complicated is it going to be to reduce water use by farmers? And again, going back to the theme of the book, if you deal with that, what are the problems, you know, downriver that you need to contend
with? Right. What that wasted water was doing something before. Now we're not wasting it. And where is it going? And I think an instant reaction that people have is, well, why are we growing anything in the desert?
Yeah.
And which is what I thought, certainly. But then I visited a farmer in the Imperial Valley. Mm-hmm. And the day that I visited, it had rained a little bit. And I said, I've brought rain. I'm doing my bit to end the drought in California. And he said, well, we really don't like rain here. In that part of the world, they get an inch and a fraction a year. When it comes, it just throws them off. The downside of that is that they have to get their water somewhere. The upside is that he can plan to the day when he is going to plant each different type of lettuce that he grows. He can plan to the day when he's going to harvest it. He knows exactly how much water he's going to put on it. And he can plan this all out a year in advance. If you're in my part of the country, you know, you have one bad storm in February and you can wipe out the entire – basically, New England's entire apple crop a couple of years ago was wiped out. There was a warm winter in which the trees blossomed prematurely, and then there was a severe cold snap and everything died. They don't have that problem in the Imperial Valley. So you could say, well, you know, why do we grow things in New England? Shouldn't we be growing everything in the desert because we're never going to have frost? I'd always thought, well, why do we grow cotton in Arizona? Because we have to put all this water on it. And in fact, Arizona cotton production peaked in the 1950s, and it's a fraction of what it was then. But if we're supposed to wear cotton as opposed to fabrics that we make from fossil fuels, maybe we should be growing it and not people in Pakistan or in India where they have worse water problems than we do. Maybe it's not a bad thing for us to be a leading producer of it rather than to have fallen down the list. And I don't know the answer to that. Or maybe we should be, you know, making our clothes from, like Under Armour, from fossil fuels. Maybe it's better to turn fossil fuels into clothing than to set them on fire to move our vehicles or to generate electricity for our electric cars. All these challenges come back to the real environmental challenges: affluence. It's us. It's, you know, there's a lot of us, and we live in unimaginable splendor by comparison with the history of the human race. And we like it for good reasons. But
and we want
it,
our tomatoes to look beautiful, and we want our potatoes right. to be a certain size, and we want our lettuce heads to be massive.
And to be tiny. We want to pluck them when they're babies so that they're easy to chew. So
yeah. I mean, there's a whole section in your book about that. Let me ask you this finally, though, David. You write about this. It's thought of as the law of the river, but it's so vague in some ways. We can't really define it. So I'm not sure how we adjust it or fix it. Do you feel ultimately optimistic? You mentioned earlier that you thought, well, there's a way that we can figure these things out. But did you come away from your reporting being optimistic about that?
On water, yes. But water's easy by comparison with some of our other environmental challenges, which are not unrelated to it. But you know, water we can do. And we've shown that we can do it. So yes, I'm very optimistic about water. I think it's harder to feel the same level of optimism about the whole complex of environmental issues that we face. You know, like rising sea levels, for example.
Yeah.
It's not going to be an easy thing to live with. Something like half the population of the United States lives in counties that are on coasts. That's a lot of people with exposure to the inevitable rise of the oceans and the strategies that we're employing now to deal with that, which basically piling up stuff between us and it, are doomed. It's barely even a short-term solution, much less a long-term one. So on the bigger issues, I don't feel this necessarily the same kind of optimism. Although I think we're human beings. I mean, look at all that we've done. There's no reason why we can't solve these problems. We know how to do it, and it's just a question of whether we apply this our extraordinary ingenuity soon enough to really make a difference, and not wait until it's too late.
It's David Owen. His book is Where the Water Goes: Life and Death Along the Colorado River. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Zoe Wolf McGinn. Technical direction today from Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.